How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Welcome to Dragon King Dark. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for joining us today. This is episode 20. Hope you have enjoyed our previous episodes. If you haven't caught them, you can get them in the archives at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Thanks a lot to Brian Alvarez and AfterDarkRadioShow.com for being the home and hosting Dragon King Dark. My look at the mysteries, the imaginative, paranormal, science, all the things that make you wonder, what's that all about? And we have taken a wide variety of topics over our last 19 episodes. And in this episode, we're going to have kind of a mixed bag of things. We're going to pull, as per request, some old articles again. One of our most popular episodes was episode 15, Old Timey Obituaries, in the writing style of the 1800s, early 1900s. Was a the newspapers, magazines were much more descriptive and salacious and imaginative and outright colorful than today's. Sometimes rather bland, rather straightforward, matter-of-fact writing style. All the newspapers nowadays, even especially the online big-name news sources, are also political and matter-of-fact. And back... You know, back in the 1800s, 1900s, writing was an art. And even if you were describing events and news or, quite frankly, some of this stuff was just salacious tabloid journalism, it was a art form to describe the scenes as colorfully and imaginative, I suppose, as outright possible. So I've had multiple requests to do some more old-timey obituaries, old-timey newspaper articles. And, of course, the first one I want to pull up is from my favorite, the National Police Gazette. And, again, if you haven't listened to episode 15, I encourage you to do so there, where I talk about the history of the National Police Gazette, a little more about it. It was a publication, just basically here, it was a publication written by or eventually bought by a gentleman named Richard K. Fox, who had come to this country as an immigrant in the 1800s and really worked his way up as a writer and an entrepreneur into ultimately buying the National Police Gazette. And the National Police Gazette was famous, if not infamous, for its outright shocking drawings and depictions of their news stories. They oftentimes went out of their way. It was really the first real tabloid journal. But it also had somewhat of a serious reputation, too. It was very much the go-to place for sporting news. Things like boxing, wrestling in particular, were heavily covered. Rowing, archery, all the big national sports that were very popular in the late 1800s were covered in detail in the National Police Gazette. And wrestling and boxing especially, that was really their main publication. That's where you went really to know who the top champions were. They oftentimes recognized their own champions and things like that, put together big matches and stuff like that. But make no mistake about it, the main event draw to the National Police Gazette was was the wild and crazy stories that they would print. And this one comes to us from May the 16th, 1896. And it is the story of an execution of a prisoner. This is from, per the national, there's actually still exist a policegazette.us website, and it doesn't seem to have been updated in a number of years. And the article archive there are a few articles there, not many, but a few, and they've been there for years now. But this one says, the following article is from the long-lost Volume 68 of the National Police Gazette and is only available through William A. Mays. It discusses in detail the execution of Carl Feinbaum, a suspect in the Jack the Ripper case, and contains his lawyer's statement of his opinion regarding his client's guilt in that case. So here we have legendary mass murderer, Jack the Ripper, a case that was never really truly solved, that terrorized London. And here is an article about someone suspected of that crime who was executed May 16th, 1896. Perhaps he was a Ripper. Feinbaum, executed at Sing Sing, had been in London, had a mania to shed blood, made a startling confession to his lawyer before he paid the penalty. He was a crafty old man. There is every reason to believe that when Warden Sage of Sing Sing Prison gave the signal for the execution by electricity of Carl Feinbaum, he legally killed the man who is responsible not only for the awful series of Whitechapel murders in London, but for similar butcheries in other parts of the country as well. The men who, as legal witnesses, saw him die knew that the miserable, shambling old hulk, strapped and trussed in the big oaken chair before their eyes like a sheep, had been convicted of plunging a murderous butcher knife into the throat of Mrs. Julia Hoffman, a New York woman who had given him a room almost as an act of charity, and that the woman's son had witnessed her death. Among the group of witnesses in that dreary death chamber was William Sanford Lawton, the lawyer who for 18 months had tried to save his client from death and who had been the recipient of a confession of a most startling character. And it is this confession, which, by the way, had nothing whatsoever to do with the killing of Miss Hoffman, which serves to show that men died only after a long and bloody career, and that in all probability it was he who for more than a year terrorized the Whitechapel district in London and murdered 12 wretched women of the street. The execution of the old man was very much like the executions which preceded it. There was a crowd of doctors, newspaper men, and lay witnesses. They assembled in the cozy office of Warden Sage and exchanged reminiscences of former affairs to while away that awkward half hour before they were summoned to the death chamber. Downstairs, the decrepit, consumptive-looking old man, in list slippers and a nightcap, was responding to the exhortations of the priest, or clutching wildly at his staggering gray hair in the ecstasy of despair. He had neither eaten nor slept in the last 24 hours of his life, and he looked more like a thing of the grave than a living being. When the hands of the clock pointed to the fatal hour, the witnesses sauntered down to the death chamber. The witnesses sat on little stools in a semicircle, with the grim-looking death chair as the center. A minute passed while the current was tested with the usual row of electric lights. The Warden Sage, who on these occasions generally suffers more acutely than the despairing prisoner, went into Feinbaum's cell. All the manhood in the hapless fellow was roused at the sound of the summons. His crying and sobbing ceased. He stood up firm and erect as a dart. Something of the old fire with which he had marched 26 years ago up the hill at Gravelot under the awful rain of bullets from the French entrenchments now possessed him. He strode forward without a tremor, actually ahead of the priest. Unaided, he stepped into the chair, took off his glasses, kissed the crucifix, and calmly sat down. Once or twice, he mopped his clammy forehead with his handkerchief. The straps were binding him when he seized the warden's hand and kissed it, saying, "You have been good to this poor fellow who had no other friend." A priest held his other hand, murmuring the prayer for the dying. Feinbaum looked up and around as the mask was put over his face to shut off his sight. The crowd around the chair stepped back. The bound figure in it slid onward and upward with dreadful force, and Feinbaum was dead. 1,820 volts of electricity coursed through his body for two periods of 5 seconds each, but the first shock had carried out the behest of the law. The first surprise came when Warden announced that the dead man had left considerable property. It had always been supposed he was penniless, and that he killed Miss Feinbaum for her money, but he not only left a house in Cincinnati, but money in the bank as well. Then his lawyer spoke. "I have a statement to make," he said, "which may throw some light on this case. Now that Feinbaum is dead and nothing more can be done for him in this world, I want to say as his counsel that I'm absolutely sure of his guilt in this case, and I feel morally certain that he is the man who committed many, if not all, of the Whitechapel murders. Here are my reasons, and on this statement I pledge my honor. When Feinbaum was in Tombs, awaiting trial, I saw him several times. The evidence in his case seemed so clear that I cast about a theory of insanity. Certain actions denoted a decided mental weakness somewhere. When I asked him point blank, 'Did you kill Mrs. Hoffman?' he made this reply: 'I have for years suffered from a singular disease which induces an all-absorbing passion. This passion manifests itself in a desire to kill and mutilate the woman who falls in my way. At such times, I am unable to control myself.' In pondering over this statement of Feinbaum's, I begin to wonder whether the sensation he described might not form an explanation of other cases. I already knew that he had been working for many years as a fireman on the Atlantic liners, sometimes on the Bremen boats, sometimes on the White Star, and at other times on the French and Inman lines. He ceased to follow the sea about 6 years ago. On my next visit to the tombs, I asked him whether he had not been in London at various times during the whole period covered by the Whitechapel murders. 'Yes, I was,' he answered. I asked him whether he could not explain some of those cases on the theory which he had suggested to me, and he simply looked at me in reply. When I asked him again whether he was or was not guilty of Mrs. Hoffman's murder, he said, 'I affirm when I go on the stand, and God will believe me just as well.' You will remember the cases of murder and mutilation of the women in Wisconsin some years ago. On the trial, we had some evidence that this man had frequently been in Wisconsin. The long knife with which Mrs. Hoffman was killed and the whetstone produced at the trial bore the marks of a Wisconsin firm at Madison, I think. These both belonged to Feinbaum, and he had carried them for some time. Now, we had no money and could not employ experts on insanity. To admit that Feinbaum committed the crime in view of the motive alleged by the prosecution was fatal unless I had expert testimony to back it. And accordingly, we went to the jury on the theory that Wimble, Feinbaum's unknown companion that night, had committed the murder. In support of the remarkable theory set up by Mr. Lawton, there are these facts. The throat of Mrs. Hoffman had been gashed across again and again. Feinbaum stood over her with the bedclothes pulled down and the knife upraised so as to begin mutilation of the body when young Hoffman awoke and saw this. In every case of murder in Whitechapel, the throat of the victim had been cut with a long, sharp knife, which might have been the kind carried by Feinbaum. In every case, the body was horribly mutilated. Feinbaum admits that he was frequently in London at different time periods during the time covered by the murders, which extended from 1887 until the summer of 1891. His description, as he was seen yesterday, fully answers that of the man seen with the two of those unfortunates, Mary Jane Kelly and Elizabeth Stride. Only on these occasions was the Whitechapel murderer ever seen. In the case of old Shakespeare, who was butchered in this city, the description of the man who went with her into the room in East River Hotel corresponded with that of the Whitechapel mutilator. And Feinbaum's appearance, without his beard, which he occasionally wore, exactly corresponds with that description. The testimony of the witnesses at the inquest on the Whitechapel women and on Shakespeare agreed on this point, that the murderer spoke German or with a strong German accent, seemed to belong to the sea. The story is a most remarkable one, and maybe, the famous Whitechapel fiend is dead. So, did they execute Jack the Ripper? Was he Feinbaum? Don't know. The Jack the Ripper story is not one I'm super well versed in. Of course, it's been legendary ever since then, and many movies have been made about it. Gosh, it wasn't too long ago. Gosh, within the last, 3 or 4 years, that there was another major motion picture about Jack the Ripper and who perhaps was. And it's been the plot of many TV shows. I can recall off the top of my head of seeing a few television shows over the years that used Jack the Ripper as a plot device. So could it have been Feinbaum? Who knows? I especially love this little jewel, as there are back in the 1800s, there was this real revival of Protestant religion going on in America. And just as Martin Luther had been famous for his Reformation movement, in the United States there became another movement called the Protestant Reformation. And in the 1800s, figures like Barton Stone and Alexander Campbell and others revived a movement inside the Protestant churches. And the old terminology, hellfire and brimstone preaching, came forth out of this movement, as with all the famous righteous indignation would come forth, and they would travel around the country holding these revivals, these old-timey, you know, tent revivals, old-timey camp revivals. They would go around usually the poorer and more sparsely populated places in the country, the Appalachians, for example, the Deep South, the post-Civil War South, the Middle America, you know, Kansas, that whole center section of the country where most people, I think about, you know, the high concentration of Protestant churches, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, those type churches. And these spawn some amazing stories. So a lot of your old gospel hymns and stuff were spawned out of this same era. And this is there's I've come across these stories many times of these revivals taking a turn for the worst, so to speak. And here's one of these stories from January the 1st, 1833. A parson lynched. He starts a revival in church and raises the devil out of it. The crooked domini outrages one of his congregation, and his beloved brethren send him to glory. A few years ago, the Reverend James Rector created a furor of religious fervor in Dearborn County, Indiana, with his elegance and saintliness. An inquiry was set on the foot a few weeks ago by his old parishioners, but very little could be learned of him until a fortnight since, when a well-known commercial traveler stopped at the old Indiana house in Aurora, Indiana, related the story of his tragic ending near a little country village a short distance from Springfield, Missouri. The traveler stated that his knowledge of the affair was obtained by being in the neighborhood at the time the tragedy took place about 1 year ago. Rector had located there and engaged actively in ministerial work. His prepossessing manners and oratory power soon brought him into prominence and gained him great popularity as a preacher. His custom of boarding around among the members of his congregation had introduced him into a respectable family consisting of two grown sons and a daughter, the latter the acknowledged belle of that vicinity. The preacher soon professed to be enamored of the farmer's daughter, and Dame Rumor had it that a wedding would be the result of the acquaintance. A protracted meeting was shortly afterward begun in that circuit, and under the powerful preaching of the rector, quite a revival had broken out. For days, the religious excitement was kept up, the people flocking in crowds for miles around to listen to the impassioned eloquence of the famous preacher. One night after a sermon of unusual effect that had brought many converts to the cause of Christ, the congregation was dismissed and Rector started, as was his habit, to accompany her home, the girl it was supposed that he intended to marry. A distance of over a mile had to be traveled. On the way, and while passing a lonely wood, he made an indecent proposal to the girl, which she resented. He attacked her with violence, overpowered and dragged her into the dark woods. The father and brothers who had preceded her homeward waited for her return. Minutes lengthened into hours, and still she did not arrive. Alarmed and anxious, they waited no longer, but started back to ascertain the cause of her delay. She was found wandering in the highway, crazed with excitement, almost denuded of clothing, and bleeding from the injuries sustained in trying to protect her honor. The story was soon told, and while the father cared for the unfortunate girl, the brothers mounted their horses and started to arouse the neighbors and avenge a sister's wrongs. A force of pursuing men soon overtook the fleeing criminal and brought him back to the scene of his outrage. There, sentence of death was pronounced, and preparations were made to hang him by the roadside. All being in readiness, he begged for a few moments to pray. The privilege was granted, and there upon his knees, in the solemn hush of midnight, with the rope that was to lynch him into eternity around his neck and the flickering glare of the blazing torch in the hands of his enemies illuminating in all their dreadful terrors the murderous scowl of his executioners, with the shadows of expiring hope settling around him, this man weakened not in the strange power he possessed to move man with the winsome words of prayer. As his voice swelled out on the night air and broke the awful stillness of that weird scene and the deep pathos and stirring sublimity of his earnest supplication began to exert a softening influence upon the group that grimly surrounded him. Fascinated by his powers, one by one they sank upon their knees beside the wretched man, and the strong resolve to punish him was melted like wax away. Suddenly, the father, remembering the miseries of his blighted home, shouted to his sons to seize the rope that swung across the limb above their heads and pull him up before he prays himself out. Willing hands and strong arms obeyed the commands, and the body of James Rector dangled in the air. The next day his corpse was cut down and buried beneath the tree on which it was hung. The revival meeting was discontinued for want of a minister. Now that there, folks, is some good old-fashioned writing. You're certainly not going to read that in the next edition of your local paper, that's for sure. Here's another colorful obituary This is from, again, my local area. This is from the Mountain Eagle. For those of you who are into comic books and are familiar with the comic book series Southern Bastards, very popular comic book series right now, the Mountain Eagle is the hometown paper of the place that is depicted there. It's Craw County is in the comic book series. It's actually based on the real life Walker County, and the Mountain Eagle is the paper from there. This is dated a little bit later than some of our more colorful obituaries, but I thought this one was pretty interesting. It's from April 8th, 1931. Harold Alexander, the son of Willie and Dovey Alexander, was born September 4th, 1927, departed this life April 8th, 1931, making his stay on earth 3 years, 7 months, and 4 days. All was done that two good doctors, father, mother, and loved ones could do, but little Harold had to answer his call. He was sick about a week when meningitis set up, lasting about a week. Little Harold suffered much till the near end, when all seemed to be peace and a great calm. He opened his precious blue eyes, looked into his mother's face, then closed his eyes for the last time and fell sweetly asleep in the arms of Jesus. Funeral services were held at Pleasant Grove Church by Elder J.D. Putnam, assisted by W.L. Kitchens. Little Harold was so tenderly borne out to the cemetery to the new-made grave and lowered to his peaceful resting place to await the glorious resurrection morn, when Christ shall come and call his sleeping dust from the silent tomb to be reunited with the spirit that is gone to God, who gave it to us for a short time. The time has been sweet little Harold has spent with us. He leaves a father, mother, sister, two grandfathers, two grandmothers, and several uncles and aunts to mourn their great loss. Little Harold was a great lover of singing and would often ask his father and mother to sing for him while he was sick. Gone in all the beauty, joy, sweetness, and radiance of youth to the sweet beyond, to unfold like a flower of rare beauty. His crossing the stream has made a new earth and a new heaven to those bereaved. Dear Harold, sleep on under your cross of lilies in the silence of your dreamless, shadowless sleep. Your spirit has joined the choir invisible and lives with God's immortals. Farewell, a long farewell. So that from April of 1931. Again, you don't get obituaries like that anymore. Speaking of acts of God, another Alexander was taken to the afterlife. August of 1933, this again from the Mountain Eagle paper. August 1933, during an electrical storm last Wednesday afternoon, August the 2nd, 1933, Willie Alexander, a young farmer of the Boldo community, was killed by lightning near his home. He was in a one-horse wagon when the accident occurred, and the mule he was driving was killed also. There was no eyewitnesses of the accident, and both man and mule were dead when found by neighbors. Funeral services were held Thursday, and burial was in the Boldo Cemetery. Surviving are the widow and one small daughter. No word on what became of the mule. Here is from the perhaps too much information department in old newspapers. You would never get sordid details like this. From today's writing, this is from the Winston Herald, May the 2nd, 1913. Mrs. Emmett Armstrong's obituary begins softly and kindly enough. Mrs. Armstrong burned to death while out assisting her husband in fighting a forest fire which was about to destroy their fencing on Thursday of last week. Mistress Emmett Armstrong's clothing caught fire, and she was so badly burned that she lived only a few hours. Emmett Armstrong lives over in Lawrence County near Gum Pond. Mr. Armstrong ran to his wife's assistance and did what he could to extinguish the flames, and in doing so burned his own hands so badly that he cannot use either of them, and fears are entertained that they will be permanently injured. The woman's clothing was almost entirely burned off. She had a large celluloid comb in her hair which caught fire, and it is said the flames from the comb reached nearly 2 feet before it could be snatched away. All our people sympathize with the bereaved husband, children, and other relatives in their bereavement over the tragic death of a good woman. Mrs. Armstrong was the daughter of Henry Warren of Ellaville. She was buried Sunday. This one's, I find, interesting because it's a Masonic obituary written by a Mason's Lodge, Freemason Lodge. Has a couple very colorful phrases, very poetic phrases used in this obituary notice. Hiram Bard Sr., Hiram, what a great Masonic name. Hiram Bard Sr., obituary from the Moulton Advertiser, one of the oldest newspapers in the state, I believe, October 9th, 1874. Tribute of respect, Houston Lodge, number 365, Houston, Alabama, September 12th, 1874. We, the undersigned, to whom was entrusted the sad duty of drafting suitable resolutions in regard to the death of our brother, Hiram Bard Sr., beg leave to submit the following. Whereas it has pleased Almighty God in the dispensations of His providence to take from our midst our brother Hiram Bard on the 7th day of September, 1874, therefore be it. Resolved, that we bow in humble submission to the sad bereavement, feeling assured that God doeth all things well, and that though we mourn our brother's death, our loss is his gain, in being taken from the shores and labor of time to the blissful realms of the Supreme Grand Master and Architect of the Universe. Resolved, that in the death of our brother, the craft has sustained a loss and the community a good neighbor and citizen. Resolved, that we tender our sympathies to the bereaved widow and family of our deceased brother, remembering that God tempereth the wind to the shorn lamb, and may He give them that consolation and support which He alone can give, and before which all earthly sympathy fails. Resolved, that in token of our respect and esteem for our deceased brother, the members of this lodge wear the usual badge of mourning for 30 days. Resolved, that these resolutions be spread among the minutes of our lodge, and that the Moulton Advertiser and the Mountain Eagle at Jasper be furnished with a copy each, and requested to publish the same, and also that the widow of the deceased be furnished with a copy of these resolutions, all of which is respectfully submitted, A.B. Hayes, J.D. Lane, and F.C. Burdick Committee. And interesting enough, 17 years later, what I presume to be his son, Hiram Bard Jr., did also pass away. This from the Daily Mountain Eagle, December 3rd, 1890, and followed up December 17th, 1890, also from the Daily Mountain Eagle. Died 6 miles east of town at 10 o'clock Friday night, the 28th, Mr. Hiram Bard, Jr., a useful and good citizen. He leaves a wife and several children to mourn his death. I so wish I wrote obituaries now, because seldom ever could I use that phrase, a useful and good citizen. I wonder if they ever put in the phrase, I probably did, useless and no good citizen. The paper follows up about a week later saying, in memory of Hiram Bard, Jr., what he said to his wife and children before he died. To his wife, he said, "You have prayed for me 1,000 times, and I have resisted. I have caused you a heap of trouble. Will you forgive me?" She said, "Yes." And he continued, I thought I was worse than Paul, who persecuted the churches. It took 3 days for the scales to be washed from his eyes. I thought that I was one of the lost tribe, but you have prayed for me, or I would have been lost. The doctors may not come, but King Jesus will carry us through. I feel good. Let me up. I feel happy. I feel better than I ever felt in my life. Did I know there was such a thing? There is Brother Crumpton. He prayed for me many times. I wish I could hear him laugh. There is Brother Adkins. He has prayed for me many times. I wish I could see him. I want to be baptized. I want Uncle Sim Smith or Billy Barton to baptize me. I must confess that I have lived wrong. Just to think that God has let me live in disobedience to his will for 50 years. If the Lord will, I should live. I will live a better life than I have. Then the song, Amazing Grace, how sweet it sounds, that saved a wretch like me. And he took a neighbor girl's hand and said, will you go with me and be baptized and be a good girl? And will you have a home in paradise? Son, this is my neighbor's child. I want my neighbors and my children to go to heaven. His son enters. Jesus Christ has come and forgiven my sins. He said, Carrie, will you go and be baptized with me? I have Roxy to go with me. I will attend to these things when I get well. When I was a boy, I would go to church and run out and say, that old fellow thought he was mighty smart, but he didn't get me. Don't you do that. Just believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that's all. I want all my children to lead a Christian life, be baptized, and be teachers of the gospel. From then, he suffered terrible until Friday night. He died Friday night, November 29th, 1890, at 11:25 o'clock. Folks, it just doesn't get any better than that. Hope you've enjoyed our second look at old-timey obituaries and old-timey news articles from Days of Yarn. Hope you've enjoyed this edition of Dragon King Dark. You can correspond with the show, and I appreciate it if you do. I hope you will. It is very simple to do. The email address is carl@dragonkingcarl.com. That is Carl with the letter K, K-A-R-L, at dragonkingcarl.com. Please also check out After Dark Radio Show. I assume you already listened to that. If not, why not? Lest the everlasting love of God pour out his vengeance upon you. AfterDarkRadioShow.com. That's where we're all located at. Check us out. Thank you very much for listening to Dragon King Dark, and we'll be back next week with another show.
How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Thinking about public reaction to all this.